My name's Bruce Dwyer, and I am grateful to be an alcoholic.
Bruce!
Breaking up already. Grateful to be here tonight. By the grace of God in a fast backfield, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since May 3rd, 1987. And I owe that all to you. You guys are my fast backfield. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was the beginner's meeting in Fredericksburg on Tuesday night. And I kind of snuck in the back door. The meeting, of course, had already started. Went over and sat on the little red bench at the back of the room and listened, maybe. I don't remember if I listened. I know I didn't hear anything, probably. And whatever I did hear sounded like it was Japanese because it made no sense to me. The only thing I heard that I remembered after I left was Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. For some reason, I remembered that. Well, the meeting was over, and then all of a sudden, we had to do this holding hands thing and the Lord's Prayer. But I didn't want to, you know, be out of, I just wanted to blend in so I could get out easy. So I did that. And as soon as they dropped the hands, I went for the door. And this little short guy with dark curly hair, and I'm pretty sure after all these years, I believe his name was Charlie. And he said to me, he put out his hands. And so did I, and he shook my hands. It seemed like he wouldn't let go. But it was all probably a couple seconds. And he said, I just want to tell you one thing. You never have to take another drink again as long as you live unless you want to. And I thanked him for his information, and out the door I went. You know, he had seen the rabbit in my eyes. And but anyway, and I'll finish up that little part of that story. Is on the way home, I thought to myself, Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I have that book. And when I got home, I found I had recently moved into this house, and I found a box that had, you know, like yearbooks and all kinds of old books. And, yeah, that you don't open. Cindy was right. And sure enough, down in that box was a hard cover copy. It was the third edition. I didn't look back then, but it was. Of the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a handwritten receipt in it from about 10 years earlier. And part of the reason I don't like doing this, I'll tell you right now, so you all know, maybe there's Kleenex around here too, my eyes leak profusely at times because my emotions get up here. But I remembered I was a bartender for a good amount of time while I was doing my career drinking. And my dad, who was a probation officer, had been a counselor, and I knew he had done some alcohol-type counseling back in his career. I remember he gave me that book when I was a bartender. And he didn't say anything about it, just gave me this book. And I remember, the only thing I remember thinking was, all right, now I can read through this and find out about all these guys sitting at my bar all day long, all night long, and then I'll understand more about these guys. I'll understand more about these guys. And so I'm sure I never cracked the cover of that book, and it went in a box. And but there it was. I had had it for 10 years and didn't know it. I was born in Massachusetts. I'm the oldest of seven kids, five boys, two girls. Middle-class family. My dad worked two jobs. Well, a full-time job and a part-time job most of the time, until my mom finally went into nursing. She had gotten her degree, nursing degree, but then she started having all seven of us. So that was her job. And anyway, we were middle class, and, you know, there was one car in the household, and Dad took it to work, and Mom tried to take care of us, and plus, because she had her degree, and she was a nurse, you know, everybody within, I don't know, a quarter of a mile of our house sent their hurt kids to our house. Go let Mrs. Dwyer check you out. But anyway, growing up was a good life. It was a good life. There was no alcoholism in our house. No, there was no real drinking in our house. My mom and dad would have like a whiskey sour if they went out, maybe one Friday night during the month, if they got to go out and have a steak and dance somewhere, they would have a drink. And my dad's father, he was an alcoholic, and he would come home drunk on weekends. That was his thing. And my dad remembered all that. And but anyway, I remember being happy. I remember fighting with my brothers and, you know, just enjoying life. Up until I was 9 years old, when I was nine, I ended up going in the hospital for, probably it was over a month. And at the same time, I was in third grade, and the third grade teacher was an old maid, and she treated all the kids like crap. Like if you dropped your pencil, you got a crayon, and then had to do your homework with the crayon. And remember those little math sheets we had that were like a half a sheet of paper? And you couldn't do all your math homework on the front and back of that with a crayon. But anyway, she was not very nice. And she even picked on the kid who was all burned up. He had been in a fire. She made him sit up front. She picked on him too. But anyway, for some reason, I accepted a lot of her crap, you know. You'll never be good enough and all that stuff. Don't know why. And then I had a fifth grade teacher who did exactly the same stuff. Now, I knew a little about her because my brothers and I delivered newspapers. And we happened to deliver them to the house she lived in with her brother. And we had to bring the newspapers to the back door. And there were these huge wooden barrels. And they were all full of liquor bottles, beer bottles, beer cans, all that stuff. So anyway, in retrospect, I understand. She probably needed a program of recovery. But anyway, she was even worse than the other one. So between these two teachers and that stint in the hospital for some skin condition that they never really knew what it was, after that, I was... What I look at now, I think I was damaged in a way. My spirit was gone. I spent all my time looking back, worrying about what you would think about me. You know, am I doing good enough? You know, like what them teachers were saying, you'll never amount to anything. You're just a bump along. And when you're always worried about what people are going to think about you, it's not a good way to live because you're not really living. You're just worrying all the time. You're being careful about what you say. When people speak to you, you're not even really listening to them because you're trying to formulate, what's my response? I want to say the right thing. And anyway, I had my first drink when I was a senior in high school and got drunk and threw up. All right, you know, the first of many. And it wasn't something that continued. Class day, the day before graduation day, I went out with my buddies in the morning because class day started like 1 o'clock or something. And we were drinking beer, and we went to this kid's house, and he handed me this 16-ounce can, which was open. And I took a sip out of it, and I said, just about wretched. catch. I said, what in the hell is this? Pardon my French. He said, oh, that's half whiskey and half beer. And, but do you know what the deal was? What did I do with it? I drank it. I drank it. And then when I went to, and then I had more beer. And then when I went to class day, apparently I smelled like a brewery. And all the girls in the class, or a lot of them, they were kind of like hovering around me, and I was up against the wall. We were supposed to be, you know, going for this processional march in or stuff. And they were trying to hold me up, and they didn't want people getting close to me, you know, teachers or whatever. Anyway, all the way down, I thought I was going to fall. I didn't fall. The person in front of me tripped going up the stairs. But I was all right. And then about halfway through the thing, we're supposed to get up, stand up. I was in chorus. Go up front. We were going to sing a song. Well, before we were supposed to get up and go up front, I got sick. Just enough, you know, like a handful. Small handful. But it was the guy beside me gave me his handkerchief. And I don't think anybody else but the girl and the guy knew, you know. But as far as I knew, you know, 400 people in the auditorium knew, you know. And I got up when she played the chord, went to the left, and instead of going down and up the front, exit stage left. And as I was running down the hallway to get out of there, the class advisor, teacher, Mr. Mark Venus, hollered, "Bruce, what's the matter?" I said, hollered back, "I'm sick." And I was sick. But anyway, that was, I haven't forgotten the experience, and I'm sure I'll never forget it. But anyway, I ended up becoming kind of like a workaholic, and I didn't drink much at all. I ended up getting married at 21, and was a workaholic, you know. Got promoted from Massachusetts to New Jersey, from New Jersey to Long Island, you know, moving my way up in this company and working lots of hours and doing all kinds of stuff. And my wife, she had a job, and she ended up getting a part-time job. Well, anyway, she met a bartender who didn't work all the hours I worked. So anyway, that marriage didn't last. Thank God that we had no children. I'm grateful for that. But anyway, I went back to my hometown of Massachusetts. And I ended up one day, the lady in this local bar said, I was unemployed at the moment. She said, how would you like a job? We'll teach you how to be a bartender. Oh, won't that be nice? And so I said, sure. And I mean, I wasn't really addicted to it then. And when I started out as a bartender, I would wait until the end of the night after everybody was out, have a drink. But within a short time, I was having a drink as soon as I got to the place, just like the three owners and the other couple of bartenders. As soon as you walked in the door, you started drinking. It didn't take me that long. I remember thinking, well, maybe I'll start having the drink as soon as we call, instead of waiting until after they're gone, as soon as we call last call, I'll have a drink. Then that'll get me, you know, I won't be as straight when everybody else is a drunk. Anyway, the bartending was the beginning of my drinking career. I found out that somebody introduced me to powdered cocaine, and I found out that if I did some of that, I could drink all night long and I didn't get sick and throw up. I mean, the next day was like hell, but, you know, drink, don't get sick. Had to keep the party going. Anyway, let's see. I ended up moving. And, geographic cure, that's what we call that. let's move to a different state. Let's get a different job. Somebody I had worked with before called me up and said, hey, I'm manager in this company. Why don't you come work for me? And so I went to New Haven, Connecticut. And that was where my drinking... I just remember, every night of the week, I was at this piano bar drinking. Every night of the week. And it got to the point where, you know how those things start happening that you're ashamed of? You know, that you would never do that if you weren't drunk or in a blackout? You know? Well, one of those things happened. There was an ice storm. And all these people that worked there, a lot of them, there was about, I forget, I think there were 70-something women that worked for me that I was responsible for. And from age 17 or 16 all the way up to 70-something. And a lot of them came on the bus. Anyway, here was an ice storm, and I didn't get up on time. And so I got there late. And they were all, some huddled in other people's cars. Others were huddled under this little tiny roof thing. And where's Bruce? Oh, he finally gets there. Not a good thing, especially when my boss got there. Not a good thing. But, you know, stuff started happening. And I ended up moving to Virginia because I had a brother here. And he said, why don't you come work in my insurance business? Help me out. He was a year younger than me, and he drank a whole lot more than I did. And plus he had his own business, so he had a lot of money. He could drink whatever he wanted. And so I went to work with him and in Fredericksburg. And I still remember one of my nephews. I was living with him. I was having a little house built, a little rambler. But I was living in the third floor of this house he had just built for him and his six boys. And I had gotten home late at night from drinking. And the next morning, I remember hearing the second boy, Sean, screaming at the top of his lungs, Uncle Bruce crashed the company car. Oh, boy. And anyway. But, and that wasn't the last time that I crashed a company car. But, like I said, my brother drank more than I did, and he was actually a maintenance drinker. And, he died at 51 from, complications to his disease, high blood pressure and other things. But, God love him. But anyway, all this time here in Virginia, working for Steve, traveling, visiting customers in five states, you know, have a relationship and doesn't work. And life just wasn't any good. And so I was depressed. I ended up seeing some different people. Then I finally ended up seeing this one lady, and she was really good. She was like really positive and upbeat, and I needed that at the time. But then we get to a certain point, and I don't know why, but I said to her, you know, I think we've gone as far as we can go. I said, I think I need somebody a little bit different to work with me. And she goes, oh, I have a friend. He'll work with you. She smiled. Well, anyway, come to find out, it was a super nice guy. And one of the first questions he asked me was, how's your drinking? And I told him like I would tell anybody else about this much. I wasn't telling you any more than that. You know, oh, yeah, I drink too much, a little problem here or whatever. You know, no big deal. I got it. Famous words. I got it. No big deal. I got it. And he was helping me with, you know, with other stuff. And he was the one who finally said, why don't you try Alcoholics Anonymous? And I wanted to hit him with the chair I was sitting in. It's like, you're not listening to me. I have all these living problems, finances, job, relationships, all this. Drinking's only this little problem over here. But after a while of him insisting that I went, I mean, I didn't have to go. I was paying him for the privilege of sitting in his office. But, you know, that's when I finally went to that first AA meeting. And I don't know when that was. It was in the fall of 1986. And you know why I don't know why it was. Because I wasn't paying attention. I didn't want to be there. I wasn't an alcoholic. Why would I pay attention to when that was? Anyway, I went through, I started going to a few meetings. And I went to Union Hall and met a lot of good people there. Sally, Leon, Mary, Hilliard, Jerry S., Corky, lots of people, good people. And I was going to some meetings at Trinity on Friday nights. I don't remember. I don't remember the timing of this, but what ended up happening is I was going to a few more meetings and meeting a few people, and I don't know what you were putting the coffee or something, but something was happening to me. And I was at a wedding reception May 2nd, 1987. And I was sitting there with my brother and his wife, and I had a date, and some other people from our family and other people. A friend of ours had gotten married, and we were at his wedding reception, Fredericksburg Country Club, and 10 of us sitting around the big table. And the waitress came. I ordered a drink, you know. I hadn't quit drinking yet. I was trying to be really careful so I didn't get in trouble again. But I didn't quit drinking, so I ordered a scotch and water. And she brought everybody's drinks, gave me mine. And before I knew it, probably less than a minute. I wasn't timing it, but it wasn't long. It was gone. And everybody else still had, like, about a full drink. And then I did what I needed to do to get that next drink. The waitress was busy, you know, with all these people in that room. So anyway, I just made some excuse. I said, you know, that waitress is so busy, I'm going to go up to the bar and get a drink. Can I get anything for you guys? Of course, they didn't need another drink, you know. So I went up there, and this is hard to talk about. Sometimes I went up to the bar and got that drink and came back to the table, sat down, picked it up and took a sip out of it and set it back on the table. And it's hot up here, isn't it? And something that you guys had said or something that my higher power was saying, the voice said, why are you doing this? And I knew exactly what the voice was talking about, drinking. And I said, because everybody else is. And the voice said, that ain't good enough. And that was it. And I didn't pick that drink back up. And the next day, I went and got a 24-hour chip. And started my journey. You know? And I started picking up chips. And started going to meetings. I think I was going every night. There were only like 7 meetings when I came in 1987. I think there were 2 on Sunday, but only one on, there was one night that didn't even have one. And But I started going to meetings, and I started picking up chips, and I had Jerry S. ask him to be my sponsor, and he said he would. And I picked up my 11-month chip at the Union Hall, and Jerry came up to me after that meeting, and he said, "Hey, Bruce," he said, "next month, on May 3rd, that'll be your one-year anniversary. We will have a cake for you," because it fell on a Saturday. And I had this dumb look on my face. And he said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Well, May 3rd can't be my sobriety date." He said, "Bruce," he said, "you've been picking up a chip on the 3rd of every month. You just picked up your 11-month chip. Why can't May 3rd be your sobriety, your anniversary?" And I said, "Because May 3rd is my real birthday." See, I didn't know for 11 months that God was trying to help me out. I only have one. The birthday and the sobriety date are the same. But I didn't know that because I wasn't paying attention. And the thing was, see, I think the reason that that I get so emotional over this stuff is there's still a part of me that way deep inside probably, but that didn't think I deserved to be saved. And I know better today. And the gratitude is overwhelming. Anyway, got my one-year chip. And, I don't know, it was later in the second year, I ended up getting married to someone who was just into their second year. And, there's a different step they call that. Anyway, I have a beautiful daughter named Katie and a son named David, and they are joys of my life. And that marriage didn't last. Actually, she wanted to drink. She didn't want to not stay stopped drinking. And so that didn't work out. And went through a horrible divorce. And at one point, I had to pay somebody $25 an hour so I could sit in a room and visit my kids. They were little, but I had legal aid, and she had her sister's money, which meant the best divorce lawyer probably anywhere at that time, Murray Van Leer. I don't know if any of you ever heard that name, but in fact, people would call me up over the years, or would ask me, "Hey, do you know of anybody for divorce, a good divorce lawyer?" And I'd say, "Yeah, Murray Van Leer. He takes no prisoners. He'll tear them up, you know? He's retired quite a while ago." But anyway, I got divorced, and I had visitation, and as it turned out, she didn't want the kids on any weekends, so which was a plus for me. I would pick them up Friday night and bring them back Sunday night, and I was working two jobs because she was taking like 65% of my pay, and at one job, the other job was Pizza Hut delivering, and I got tips so I could kind of like live a little. And the guys at Pizza Hut knew, oh, if there's an extra pizza or a bad pizza, the wrong pizza, give it to Bruce. He needs it. And Saturday mornings, I would take the kids somewhere around noon. We'd go to Pizza Hut. And they wanted the cheese lover's pizza. Stuffed crust cheese lovers with all the cheese. And I enjoyed my time with my kids. And a ways down the road, she she ended up having a DUI. She crashed her car with the kids in it. Luckily, they were not hurt. She wasn't hurt either. But I was in a meeting with Miss B, if any of you remember Miss B, on a, that, I forget what night of the week it was. Could have been a Sunday. I don't remember. And my cell phone went off, and it said something weird. So I stepped out in the hallway, and the guy says, "This is Sergeant Lieutenant, somebody with the Virginia State Police. Your ex-wife and children are fine, but they've been in an accident, and your ex-wife is being arrested for DUI. Can you come get your children?" And we went and got my children. And I still remember, it's a little joke, when I took Dave and Katie back to the place that I was renting, Katie looked, she had blood on the top of her head, I noticed, when she was sitting at the chair in front of me. And so I took like a little towel or something, and I was slowly wiping at the blood. You know, I figured maybe it was a little cut from the flying glass or whatever. Well, we got down to her scalp and there was nothing there. Apparently it was her mom's blood. But anyway, I became Mr. Mom for probably close to 4 years. And I wouldn't change anything about it. The kids went with me to meetings. They always knew about meetings because we were both in the fellowship in the beginning. When they were born, they were in little bassinets in between us at the meetings. But anyway, I was concerned about them and their relationship with their mom. And so I asked people about Alateen. And they said, well, there used to be some in Fredericksburg, but it hadn't been here for a few years. And something told me to look deeper into it. And I found Miss Alateen, Mrs. Alateen in Manassas, Miss Margaret. And we went to an Alateen meeting there and met Miss Margaret. She told me, well, if you want to do this and this and this and this, you can have Alateen in Fredericksburg. So we did that. And I think I was a Alateen sponsor for about 10 years. And, I do have a good way to get, if you're looking for someone to do that kind of work, I told these guys who were friends of mine who had some time, I said, your higher power told my higher power for me to ask you if you would consider being an Alateen sponsor. And they both did it. One of them said it was the most rewarding thing of his life. The other one said he would never, ever do it again. He couldn't handle kids. But anyway, so for those, while the kids were growing up until about, 2005, I was in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the middle of Alateen, went to some Al-Anon meetings because I had to. And life was good. Life was good. Couldn't have been better. Because I was where I was supposed to be. Doing what I was supposed to be doing. Well, one of my nephews called me up. And he said, Uncle Bruce, how would you like to have coffee with his wife's mother? And I was at their wedding and met her, but didn't even remember what she looked like. And I said, sure. In fact, the kids and I were on our way to a concert, James Taylor concert, in Charlotte, North Carolina. We were on our way to my brother's house, who lives down that way. And when I got the phone call from Scott. And anyway, I said, well, you know, probably I'll talk to you when I get back. We're on this trip. Well, anyway, I ended up meeting this lady, and I fell in love with her. And she seemed to have her ducks in a row. She had her own business for a long time, and she didn't drink. And anyway, I ended up getting married to her. And after getting married, things started changing. And I found out what real control was all about. She was very, very extremely controlling. But like I said, I was in love with her. And when you're in love with somebody, you overlook a lot. You know? And because my first two wives, you know, when marriage got tough, difficult, whatever, you know, they ran. And I always figured, you know, I always thought that the vows were important, you know, no matter what. You stick with it. Work it out. That's how my folks did it. But anyway, so at the, and I'll say this, at the expense of my relationship with Katie and her brother, because that relationship declined when I had my new wife, and there were other things involved, but anyway, we got married, and I cut back on my meetings, and then I stopped going to meetings. She didn't want me to go to meetings because she didn't want me hugging women, and women hugging me. And what did I say? Oh, I was in love. So I did that. And over the course of 10 years, the next 10 years, I went to 3 meetings when she happened to be away. About every 2 months, I would call my sponsor without fail, because I wanted him to know what was going on with me. Because it occurred to me, if you call your sponsor up and it's been 4 years and you say, I'm in the shit, I don't know what to do, well, then you got to tell him about a whole bunch of stuff. And I didn't want that. So I would call Clay up and tell him, you know, this is what's going on in my life. And I wasn't having problems, you know. I wasn't having problems. Not once during all that time did I think of a drink. Not once, you know. And I credit that to my higher power, but also to those first 19 years of being a part of this fellowship. And I just got lost, Clay. And I had 3 guys that I would call also. And one guy in Fredericksburg that I would see on occasion because he repaired some of our equipment. We had our own small business. And so I worked hard in the business, and we had her 10 grandkids, and we had, at any given time, there were 12 of us living in the same house. And it was, you know, because her kids always kept coming home. You know, it would be her daughter and the husband and then the 2 kids. And then there'd be another one come in. And then there were still her 2 youngest sons that were still with us. So 4 and 4 and 4. And then these 4 would leave, but then her other daughter would come with their 4. And I told somebody my life back then was like being on a freight train, you know, going down the tracks full blast. You know, if you don't think about getting off, there's no way. And I wasn't. My life was good. It was busy, and I loved her kids. I loved her grandkids. There was no question about that. I did miss my kids and didn't get to see them very often, and I regret that today. But it's different now, and that's great. Anyway, we get all the way to 2016. Oh, and part of that time I lived in Idaho and Pennsylvania and different places. And we get to 2016. We had been out in Idaho because she has a daughter out there. And we were out there for like 4 months in the winter. And it was beautiful, way up in the mountains. And we decided we would sell our business, sell the place we're living, and move to Idaho. Get a small job. You know, I was already collecting Social Security because I'm old. And anyway, we sell the business quickly. We sell the place we had quickly. And all of a sudden, I went from my annual checkup, which I had done the past 9 years. You go in on a one day, they take your blood, your EKG. You come back the next week, they look at your blood and your EKG, said you're all set. Here's your blood pressure and cholesterol script for the next year. See you then. Only that wasn't the way it was this time. There was something wrong. And I ended up going to the hospital, and because they didn't know what was wrong. My pulse was 120-something. And the week before when they checked me out, it was like 63. And my blood pressure was off the chart. And I went to the hospital, and the next morning some guy came in. They thought, oh, maybe atrial fibrillation, something. Oh, atrial flutter. That was what maybe I had. But the doctor the next morning said, nah, we didn't really see any of that. And I said to him, I don't remember what else he said, but I said, hey, doc, I got a headache. Think I could get something for my headache? And he said, well, what kind of headache is it? And I said, well, you know, it starts up here and goes down the back of my neck, and I get them every once in a while. You know, I take some extra strength, Excedrin or whatever, goes away. He says, well, maybe we ought to take a CT. Fine with me. Do whatever needs to be done. Well, that afternoon, this other doctor came in one of them white coats. And he says, Mr. Dwyer, my name's such and such. I'm a neurosurgeon. I had a tumor called a meningioma sitting up here, and it was about the size of a Hostess Twinkie. And he said to me, he said, if you're going to have a brain tumor, this is the best kind to have. He says, meningioma grows between your skull and the top of your brain. They're almost always, benign and very slow growing. But this has to be removed. And so I went through all kinds of stuff and doctors. I ended up at UVA, and they took out the Hostess Twinkie, and everything went fine. And I went to rehab because I was a little weak on this side, and got out of rehab. They said, you're all set. You're good. You can walk good. You can talk good. Your brain's working right. I go home, wake up the next morning. Something hurts. I was having chest pains. And I said to myself, no way am I going to say anything to anybody. I just get out of this stuff. Well, by 6 p.m., I was telling my wife, dial 911, because I couldn't stand the pain. And she did, and I went to the hospital. And the next morning at Mary Washington, here we go, the next morning again, the doctor comes in, and he says, Mr. Dwyer. He wasn't grinning. He said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you have double pneumonia. You have PEs, which means blood clots in your lungs, and you have DVTs, which means your legs are full of blood clots. And I looked at him and I said, how did I get all that? He said, well, some people who have major surgery, some older people is how he put it, who have major surgery, get some of these. And I looked at him and said, and I get all three? He didn't have an answer. And so Mary Washington started trying to treat me, and because I had the brain surgery only two weeks before, they couldn't give me blood thinners for the clots. And so it was like rock and hard place. Anyway, after a week there, my ex-wife said to him, we were married at the time, she said, he needs to go to Charlottesville. And they, from what she said, they told her, if you've got the $40,000 or $50,000 to med flight him, fine. So anyway, I was there another week to the day. And that morning I was up in the bed, not standing up, but close to it, screaming at the top of my lungs, no words. Because come to find out, the clots were moving in my lungs. And not good. So they med-flighted me to UVA. And UVA got me better. And then I went to a rehab in Culpeper. And they called my wife up that afternoon. I've been there for a week or something. And they said, Mrs. Dwyer, your husband is non-responsive, and his temperature is 102.5. We're sending him across the street to Culpeper Hospital. And she was on her way to see me, so she came to the hospital. And come to find out, I had a urinary tract infection, and my temperature went to 104.2 before they got it to start coming down. And then I ended up going to Fairfax and Nova, and it was 9 weeks in 4 hospitals, 2 rehabs, and some of them more than once at the place. But laying in the hospital in all those beds in rehab and whatever, I had this joke going. I'd look at the ceiling, all those white tiles, and I'd say, okay, God, I'm really interested in where your path is leading. Because I knew it was our joke. I knew I was on the path. And I knew he wasn't going to tell me where I was going. But I also knew, through all of that, I knew that everything was going to be okay in my life. Now, if okay meant I was going to die, it was okay. You know? And I finally ended up, by the time I got through all of that, most of that, I couldn't walk because I had been in bed for so long. And I ended up going back to rehab and doing all kinds of stuff. Get home, you know, guys coming to help me walk up and down stairs and whatever. And all this stuff. And then my wife says to me on a, what heck was it? It was a Sunday. Sunday afternoon, she had been with her daughter. And up in West Virginia, where her daughter owned some property. And she came back in and she said, I'm leaving you. And I go, what? She said, I'm leaving you. And anyway, I said, well, you know. She just wanted out. And, I said things like, you know, I hope you're not picking this year, the most difficult year that we've ever had in our marriage and whatever, to make this kind of decision based on. But she didn't want to hear anything. She didn't want to hear about counseling or anything. And so anyway, the next evening, I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous because I know what to do. I called Clay as soon as she told me that she was leaving, because I know what to do. And you told me, when life hits you upside of the head with a 2x4 or a 4x4 or whatever, call your sponsor and go to a meeting. That's what you do. And so I did that. And Tuesday, she drove off into the sunset. And I started going to 2 and 3 meetings a day for a good long time. Because I needed my medicine, you know. I didn't want to drink, but I hurt, you know. And I couldn't, you know, when that kind of stuff happens, you know, it's kind of like, you mean all this other stuff happened, and now this is going on? You know, and I have to hurry up. But there was only one time when I got depressed, and that was when I was in that rehab before I had the UTI and they took me out of there. It was because it was on 4th of July weekend. There was nobody there to work with you or do anything. And so I just laid in the bed for a few days. And I did, at that point, get a little bit depressed. But it didn't last, thank God. Anyway, I found out that after the fact that my wife took every penny that we had and put it. It was cash. We had a lot of cash in the safe. Took it all, put it in her daughter's bank account, and I wasn't to see a penny of it. And that's just the way it was, you know. So, but you know. When I went through that other first divorce with Kay's mom, you know, I got knocked back down, you know, to where I was at Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, even though I was in the middle of fellowship, all that stuff. And this time, you know, I get everything taken away, you know, and I'm back at Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where I belong. And, you know, I have no regrets today. You know, I haven't talked about the steps, but, you know, over the course of all this time, I have worked the steps. I pray to God every day, every night, driving the car. I ask Him for His will, whether it's noticing the guy behind me at Wawa who's coming in the door 12 steps behind me and holding the door for him, or whether last night, 15 minutes before the meeting was to end, the guy shares, and I know him, and he was hurting over something. And after he shared, and one more person was sharing, he went up and ran out the door. And I don't know why, but I ran out the door after him. I didn't run. I can't run real good. All the blood clots are still in my legs. But anyway, and we talked. We talked, and I hugged him. And I said, come on, let's go close this meeting out. Oh, I can't go back in there. I just ran out. I said, yeah, you can. Come with me. And we went back in, and we closed the meeting, held hands, said the Lord's Prayer. You know? What's God's will for me? It's easy. Just be open to it. Just be open to it. But anyway, you know, I want to thank Sam for coming and speaking at the Fredericksburg group. And I also want to thank him for asking me to come here and speak, you know, at your group. I don't really like doing this, but it's part of my service to you people in this fellowship. And I'm sure as soon as I get down from here, I'll think of 800 things that, I wanted to say. But guess what? And I told Sam at the beginning, this is my favorite tie. Is he Snoopy jumping around here? I told him, I said, before the meeting, and I said, this is not me right now. But when I'm done speaking, this will be me. Anyway, thank you very much. God bless you all. Yeah.